You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. And welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum again. I'm Judy Ansel. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Pipefitters Local 533 and Roofers Local 20. Pipefitters Local 533, being the best in the industry, is earned. Our craftsmanship, brotherhood, training, and job safety make the difference. Building and buying union create better wages and living standards for all working families. And Roofers Local 20, apprenticeship, provides the highest quality roof applicators in the region, accredited by the United States Department of Labor's Bureau of Apprenticeship Training. Our program provides Local 20 contractors with a workforce second to none. Craftsmanship and quality is what we do on time and within budget is how we do it. For more information on roofer apprenticeships, call 913-281-2527. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, on June 27th, the Pregnant Worker Fairness Act went into effect with new protections for women workers. Tonight on the show, we will learn who is covered and what new rights and expecting mothers in the workforce will have. Then, how do you blow the whistle on safety hazards at work and not get fired? We'll talk to representatives from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, about whistleblower protections. In the news, UAW and Starbucks workers hitting the bricks. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Ariana Blackman with a little auto worker history. And now for the news.
Now for the news from our side. On Wednesday night, UAW President Sean Fain gave an important update on the state of the negotiations. The contract for 150,000 auto workers expires 11:59 tonight. The bottom line, UAW members are strike ready if the big three automakers don't come to the table with a fair and just contract. Fain said, "We do not yet have offers on the table that reflect the sacrifice and contributions our members may have made to these companies. To win, we're likely going to have to take action. We are preparing to strike these companies in a way they've never seen before." He said, "They want to scare American people into thinking that auto workers are the problem. We're not the problem. Corporate greed is the problem. And come tomorrow night, if they force us, we're about to make it the big three's problem." Fain continued, "Having your plant closed down and your family scattered across the country is hell. Being made to work during pandemic and not knowing if you might get sick or die or spread the disease to your family is hell, and enough is enough."
And here's some background on the likely UAW strike. These negotiations and the strike, pending a last-minute tentative agreement tonight, are historic. That's because, for the first time since the era of one-party rule began in the late 1940s, United Auto Worker members had a direct vote in electing their president. And for the first time, a rank-and-file caucus of members, UAWD, the D stands for democracy, has had a significant voice in shaping the priorities for negotiations. For years, the so-called administration caucus ran the union, took massive concessions without much fight back, engaged in close collaboration with management through jointness and teams, and introduced a culture of corruption, which led to 9 top officials' conviction and jailing for taking bribes from the owners. That led to the government forcing the union to introduce one man, one vote, which led to the election of Sean Fain as president and their chief negotiator. Fain is now accountable to the members and is under a lot of pressure to deliver. And it's looking more and more like the big three want to strike. They have been very slow to make counteroffers to the UAW negotiating proposals, so slow, in fact, that the union has had to file failure to bargain in good faith charges against them at the National Labor Relations Board. That despite the fact that their CEOs have gotten enormous increases in compensation based on gigantic profits they've been making off the backs of their workers. Profits, according to Fain, are up 65% over the last 4-year contract. Fain says, echoing Walter Reuther back in 1946, they could double our wages and not raise car prices and still make billions of dollars in profit. Clearly, wages are a key issue for all workers. One Ford worker told us he's exhausted from working so much overtime just to make ends meet. Even the older workers haven't had a real raise since 2008, that recession. So getting a raise to a good wage is a high priority. The other big issue is ending the two-tier wage system, which pays workers hired since the big concessions of 2008 a far lower wage and no pension. It can take as long as 22 years to reach top pay. The two-tier system creates tremendous resentment and division within the union. So does the system of hiring temps. It's reported that for some, it takes 6 years to gain a regular job. While the number of temps is currently capped at 8% at Ford, there's no path for them to become regular employees. With expectations and militancy at a high, there's tremendous pressure on Fain to deliver sizable gains. There are many other issues like job security and unionization of the electric car manufacturing, more paid time off, cost of living adjustment, and retirement. Fain announced last night that if there's a strike, the union may engage in what he called stand-up strikes. What that may mean is rolling strikes from one plant or shift to another and from one company to another, keeping all the big three car makers guessing who will work today and who won't. It's novel and could create a lot of pressure on the companies to cave to union demands, or it could provoke lockouts. Stay tuned, and if there's a strike, there will be pickets at the GM Fairfax and Ford Clay Como plants, just so you know where you can show your solidarity. Fain said, the UAW will announce its plans tonight at 10:30 p.m. AFL-CIO President Liz Schuler said the entire labor movement stands in strong solidarity with UAW members.
Today was Starbucks Day of Action, with customers joining workers in leafletting and demonstrating at stores. There was an action at 75th Street Starbucks in Overland Park. Since December 2021, more than 8,500 Starbucks workers have organized 350-plus stores. Meanwhile, the company has committed record levels of unfair labor practices, initially ignoring labor laws. One recent example of Logan Matthews, a worker in Jonesboro, Georgia. Matthews was hired personally by the company founder, Howard Slotz, 26 years ago. But Matthew became a lead organizer among the Jonesboro workers on September 7th, 2 days after he co-signed a detailed 3-letter page to Slotz's successor as company CEO, announcing the organization drive and detailing the reason for it. Matthews was fired. He previously worked at 50 other stores, helping to open 8. Today's news was read by Judy Ansel, and I'm Morty Mortensen. Sloat.
We have plowed and we have planted. We have gathered into barns, done the same work as the men, with babies in our arms. But you won't find our stories in most history books you read. We were there, we're still here, fighting for the things we need. We were there in the factories. We were there in the mills. We were there. Shops in New York, from the fields in California, where our children had to work. We fought to make a living. Bread and roses was our pride. Though they jailed and beat our bodies, our spirit. African and Jew, Italian and Latina, Chinese and Russian too. They tried to use our differences to split us all apart, but the pain we felt together touched the bottom of our heart. We were there in the factories. We were there.
Good evening. I'm your host, Christine Disming. On this half of our show, we're going to talk to Sarah Braffman, National Policy Director of A Better Balance, about what you need to know about the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, or the PWFA, an act that recently went into effect as of June 27th, kind of a positive step towards workers that are pregnant or recently just had a child. So, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Christina.
Well, first of all, could you introduce yourself and the work that you're a part of with A Better Balance?
Yes. So I am National Policy Director of A Better Balance. We are a nonprofit legal advocacy organization working to fight for and advance protections for working families so they don't have to choose between caring for themselves, caring for their loved ones, and their economic security. We work to advance policies like the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, like protections around breastfeeding, paid family and medical leave, paid sick time, and other similar types of protections.
That sounds like absolutely excellent work they're doing. That's needed everywhere. And I'm glad it's not just for pregnant workers, but it's for all workers throughout the United States. So, I mean, that's excellent work that you guys are doing. And with the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, could you kind of talk about what the PWA is and how does it differ from ADA? Because probably some of our listeners will want to know that.
Absolutely. The Pregnant Workers Fairness Act is a new nationwide federal civil right. And what the law does is to say employers have to provide reasonable accommodations for known limitations related to pregnancy, to childbirth, or other related conditions, so long as those accommodations don't cause an undue hardship on business, meaning they would be very difficult for a business to provide or very expensive. The reason why we needed a new law is because protections like the Americans with Disabilities Act only provided accommodations for workers who had pregnancy-related disabilities, meaning if they already had pregnancy complication that rose to the level of a disability, then they could get accommodations under the ADA. But if they didn't have a disability yet, they just needed an accommodation to prevent a disability from arising, then they couldn't get an accommodation under the ADA. And some of the listeners may also know about the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. Under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, a law that was passed in 1978, the law was basically designed to say you can't fire someone because they're pregnant, you can't not hire them just because they're pregnant. And in a small number of circumstances, if they were to provide accommodations to other workers who were similar in their ability or inability to work, then pregnant or postpartum workers could get accommodations. But that whole gobbledygook that I just said really left a lot of workers in the gap, right? They didn't have someone in their workplace they could point to that was getting accommodations such that they could get accommodations. They didn't have a disability that they could get accommodations for under the ADA. And so they were getting forced out onto unpaid leave or fired or forced to keep working with real health needs, but they needed a paycheck. And so they couldn't get the accommodations they needed. So the PWFA is really a sea change in how we need to approach and how employers now need to approach workplace accommodations for pregnant people, for postpartum people, and people with other conditions, right? Like fertility-related reasons, or lactation, people that need to breastfeed at work and need accommodations for that as well.
I know, personally for me, last year I had a high-risk pregnancy and I ended up actually the best outcome that I could, but I had to use up my days. At my workplace, people were really accommodating, but I hear these absolutely horror stories from workers across the board who feel like they've been penalized for being pregnant or having to have some minor accommodations, stuff that was very, very reasonable. And now that we have the PWFA, it feels like it gives them a little, this is a win. I'm glad to be reporting on something positive about this, but this is something, a little bit of an act that's a little stronger, that has a little bit more teeth to it. So what penalties are there for companies that do violate PWFA?
It's a great question. And another important thing to know about the new law is that there are very strong retaliation protections. So it's not just that employers have to provide the accommodations, it's that they can't punish you for even asking for an accommodation or using an accommodation. And I think it's really important to understand that that those protections are in place as well. And like you said, the law has teeth. So the same process that's in place for violations of the Civil Rights Act are the same ones that are in place for the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, meaning if you think your rights have been violated, you can file with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or the EEOC, and they will investigate the complaint. And there can be a whole wide range of penalties if there's been a violation, including real damages for, wages lost, attorney's fees, all real like protective penalties here, so that if there is a violation, people are made whole. The other thing is, after you bring an investigation with the EEOC, there is opportunity to then bring a lawsuit on your own. If the EEOC chooses not to litigate the case, they will give you a right to sue notice, and you can then have your day in court, because everyone who has their rights violated should be able to have that opportunity as well. So it's really, we hope that employers will comply. The point of the law is to provide clarity to business. Business was very supportive of the passage of the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, but we know that some employers will not comply. And it's really important that folks know that there are real ways to remedy. And I would say as well, A Better Balance runs a free legal helpline. We are a nonprofit, so it's not the government, but we can talk you through your options if you think your rights have been violated, and share information with you about the law.
And that's good to know that there's a little bit of a backbone to this act, because plenty of people won't even ask for accommodations because they feel like they're going to be retaliated against. But clearly, this does give you steps to make sure that you know your rights and that you're able to do what's best for you and your family and a workplace that you enjoy, that you like to stay in. And right now, I'll go one back up a little bit. So this act has passed, but what activism helped the passage of PWFA?
A Better Balance has been leading the fight for the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act for a decade. It took 10 years to get this bill from introduction in Congress to passed and signed into law by President Biden. And over those 10 years, we amassed a huge movement of over 700 organizations supporting the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. And because we work directly with workers and we're seeing day in and day out people being pushed off the job, we really led with workers. Workers were the face of this movement and sharing their experiences. And our community advocates testified. They wrote op-eds. We've had people stand in front of the Senate and the Capitol to share their stories, meet with their legislators. And our co-founder and co-president, Dina Vax, testified twice before Congress about the urgency of this issue. We, over the years, released dozens of reports and fact sheets and did rallies. And this was a real movement, because we knew that pregnant people were being ignored. Their needs were being ignored. People were losing out. You know, we talked not just about the motherhood gap when it comes to equal pay, but the pregnancy penalty when it comes to equal pay, when you get pushed out for being pregnant and needing these accommodations. And the last thing is that we didn't just push federally. We worked state by state to get laws passed that are similar to the new federal law at the state level. And there are now 30 states that have protections in place that are similar to the PWFA. Those remain on the books, so people can enforce their rights both under state law and federal law where they have a state law, because we knew people needed these right away and states were able to act faster. But now we're in a world where no matter what state you live in, you have the protections of the federal law.
And glad that all these people came together, and also with the Better Balance and to do this, because way too often we hear negative things, and this is a point of frustration for a lot of people, but this is positive news that all this work came out with the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. It came out with a victory. And for those of you who are just joining us in, We are talking to Sarah Braffman, National Policy Director of A Better Balance, about the impact of the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. So my next question is, so someone's in the workplace, they feel like their job is not accommodating for their pregnancy. What actions can workers take?
So the first action is to try to talk with your manager, your supervisor, HR, to request the accommodation. And not only do we have a free legal helpline, we crafted a template at A Better Balance. If you go to www.abetterbalance.org to request accommodations, it's a short couple paragraph letter that you can submit that makes it really easy to put in this request and try to get what you need. And really, it's about having a conversation with your employer about what your needs are and having that back and forth over what will work for you, what will work for them. It may not be the case that you get the exact first thing you ask for, but you do need to get something that meets your needs to keep you healthy and to keep you working. And so you can, and there is no set list of accommodations that you have to pick from. It's not like a drop-down menu where only 10 are available. It's really asking for what you individually need. Just to give common examples, again, not exhaustive, but asking for light duty, asking for extra breaks, asking for a flexible schedule or time off to attend prenatal, postnatal appointments, asking for uniform modification if you need a new uniform because you're breastfeeding or because you're pregnant, time off for fertility appointments, leave to recover, unpaid job protected time to recover from childbirth. So leave can be an accommodation that you request as well. So these are just some examples to get your mind sort of jogging about the types of things you can ask for. A temporary transfer if you need one. And then hopefully you have that back and forth and you come to the conclusion about what accommodation you need. The other thing to note is your needs might change over the course of your pregnancy. And that's okay too. You can ask for an accommodation that lasts a couple months because you're having terrible morning sickness, and then your needs change because really what now you need is help with lifting because your pregnancy is progressing and it's getting harder to lift things and harder to move. And so that your accommodation request can evolve. If you're having trouble getting the accommodation you need, that's when you call A Better Balance and talk with us, and we will talk through information about how to navigate with your employer, discuss the options if around escalation, if that's needed. And really our goal is to try to get folks the accommodation they need in the timeliest way, because we know pregnancy is a temporary period. There's not time to, often have these protracted, conversations with employers. They really need to take place quickly.
And well, we know that PWFA is clearly a win, but what are the next steps? What do we hope to accomplish before the end of this decade?
Like you said, Christina, this is a really exciting victory. It was 10 years in the making. It was a movement. There were so many organizations that were a part of it, so many legislators. It was incredibly bipartisan. So we had really strong support from both sides of the aisle, which is another reason for hope. And there is more to be done. This is a beginning, not an end. We need comprehensive paid family and medical leave in this country. We are one of the only nations, the only developed nation that does not have a paid family and medical leave program. There are people that go back to work days after giving birth, and that's not right. We need a comprehensive program. We need paid sick days in this country. There are 30 million people in this country who still don't have a single day of paid sick time when they get sick, when their child gets sick, when a loved one gets sick, or for preventative care, right? Just we should all be able to go to routine doctor's appointments. And that's what sick time is for too. And we need that. We need fair and flexible scheduling. There are too many workers in this country who have no idea what their schedule is going to be until a day, if not hours before, cannot schedule their life, cannot schedule childcare, are grappling with that. So we need that too. And the list goes on and on and on, but I'll leave folks with those three very concrete next steps.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Christina.
And that was Sarah Braffman talking about the PWFA, the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. Thank you for listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Christine Disming. Stay tuned for the second half of our show.
Coming up Thursday, September 21st at 7 p.m. on the People Power Hour, brought to you by Casey Tenants, we'll be talking about the Tenant Bill of Rights. Our guests will be Brandy Granados and Janae Manley, two people that were instrumental in both writing it and getting it passed. Want to know how we got here and how it can protect you from slumlords? Tune in to the People Power Hour, brought to you by Casey Tenants, on September 21st at 7 p.m.
KKFI is the Kansas City area's independent, non-commercial, community radio station. We seek to stimulate, educate, and entertain our audience, to reflect the diversity of the local and world community, and to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues, and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. And that is the KKFI mission statement. Thank you for listening.
Bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
I wanted more. Day, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis, prolonged long black lung disease, and radiation that hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck.
That was More Than a Paycheck by Sweet Honey on the Rock. This is Rebecca Markham Parker with Heartland Labor Forum. How do you blow the whistle on work safety hazards and not get fired? Tonight we are talking about Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, and the whistleblower protections. Our guest is Sarah Linthicum. She is an OSHA Whistleblower Protection Program investigator from Region 7, which covers Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, and Iowa. So welcome to the program. And please tell us about OSHA and the Whistleblower Protection Program. And what is retaliation?
So OSHA is a part of the Department of Labor. The Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970, or the OSH Act, as we call it, is part of the department. Was passed to prevent workers from being killed or seriously harmed at work. The law created the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, which sets and enforces protective workplace safety and health standards. OSHA also provides information, training, and assistance to employers and workers. Under the OSH Act, employers have the responsibility to provide a safe workplace. OSHA's Whistleblower Protection Program enforces protections for employees who suffer from retaliation for engaging in protected activities. Protected activities are things like reporting potential violations or hazards to management. It could be reporting a work-related injury or illness. It could be providing information to a government agency, filing a complaint, instituting or causing to be instituted any proceeding under or related to a relevant act, or assisting, participating, testifying in proceedings, or it could be a valid work refusal. Retaliation occurs when an employer, through a manager, supervisor, or administrator, fires an employee or takes any other type of adverse action against the employee for engaging in a protected activity.
How does someone know where their complaint will be assigned or which region to contact?
Well, complaints are generally sent to the region the complainant was employed in or to the area in which the decision was made for the adverse action.
Have complaints increased in the last 10 years?
Yes, complaints have increased in the last 10 years. Part of the reason is that we have 25 plus statutes now, but also there's been an uptick due to that dreaded C word, COVID.
So what percentage of complaints end up being investigated?
I don't really have an exact number for the percentage that end up being investigated. What we do is we screen through everything that comes through our office and then see of those which ones really truly need investigated by us and which ones sometimes need referred, or which ones they just don't have quite what we're looking for in order for us to investigate.
What are some of the 25 statutes you see in your area?
Aside from those related to general health and safety, which fall under the OSH Act, we also see railroad cases, trucking cases, food safety, as well as a few financial type cases. There are many statutes, and some we don't see as much just due to our location. You know, an example would be the Seamen Protection Act. We're not near the ocean, so we're probably not going to see very many of those cases.
Is the program throughout the whole United States?
It is. 11C covers all persons working in the private sector of the United States.
Terrific. So what are some examples of employee concerns that were founded, and how did you protect those employees?
Well, first we want to say that all safety and health concerns are valid. We affect the most good for employees when we are able to make settlements or to reinstate the employees' jobs, or award the employee front pay, back pay, and even in some cases where appropriate, we're able to reward them compensatory damages, such as monetary damages, such as those from medical expenses, fees, penalties, etc., or non-monetary damages, things like emotional distress, pain, suffering, those kind of things.
So what are employer responsibilities?
So the responsibility of the employer is to not retaliate against any worker for using their rights under the law. Employers are required to provide a workplace that is free of known safety and health hazards. All covered employers are also required to display the OSHA poster, Job Safety and Health, It's the Law, in their workplace. The poster must be prominently displayed where workers can see it, and this poster is available for free from OSHA.
Excellent. So what other government agencies do you work with and refer others to?
We do a lot of work referring back to the compliance division in OSHA. A lot of times people mistake us for all being compliance officers. They think OSHA, everybody there goes out and inspects. We don't. Sometimes people are trying to make an anonymous complaint about just a safety or health issue, and they get us by mistake. So that's probably our number one referral, but we also refer to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and they enforce laws that prohibit discrimination against employees because of race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, national origin, age, disability, or genetic information. And then there's the Wage and Hour Division. The Wage and Hour Division is another division of the Department of Labor. It enforces the federal laws on the minimum wage, overtime pay, wage record keeping, child labor requirements. And Wage and Hour also enforces the Family and Medical Leave Act, migrant and seasonal worker protections, and worker protections in certain temporary guest worker programs, and the prevailing wage for government-funded service and construction contracts. And finally, our most common referral is the National Labor Relations Board, and they protect the rights of the most private sector employees to join together with or without a union to improve wages and working conditions.
Terrific. This is Rebecca Markham Parker. We are speaking with Sarah Linthicum of OSHA's Whistleblower Protection Program on KKFI's Heartland Labor Forum, 90.1 FM. So can you tell us about some of the more interesting cases that you have seen in your course with the Whistleblower Protection Group?
I really can't give any particular information just based on that we protect information of any, but I can say that we have a wide variety of cases that come in. Like I said, we do some trucking cases, we do some railroad cases, And sometimes we are able to get settlements and reinstatements that are quite significant in these workers' lives.
That's fantastic. So how do employees contact you or find more information about filing a complaint?
Sure, you can go online. We have a website. You can fax, you can mail, you can email us, you can call and telephone, or you can come in person. We accept complaints in any language. If you need assistance, such as a foreign language interpreter, you can contact your local OSHA regional or area office. You can also visit www.whistleblowers.gov to learn more about OSHA's Whistleblower Protection Program and how employers can develop or improve their programs. We do outreach, and we would love to come out and help you if there's anything that an employer thinks they might need. Also, our number to call is 1-800-321-6742.
Great. So I was really impressed when I went on the website in that there isn't just one format for complaints, but there are many different ways that people can contact you. So really, it seems like a very open process.
It is. We try to make it as user-friendly as possible so that no matter what your preferred method is, you know, there's still people who don't like using computers. That's okay. Call us on the phone. There's still people that might want to send a fax. That's all right. We'll take those too.
Terrific. What can a complainant expect during a whistleblower investigation?
First, we need to have current contact information. So when somebody calls, emails, whatever, however they get a hold of us, we need to make sure that you put the current information so that we can contact you. Then complainants are screened to make sure that they meet the criteria for a whistleblower investigation. And if the complainant does meet the criteria, the investigation will be assigned to one of our seven investigators, at least in this region. We have seven. If the complainant, then all investigators, we are neutral fact finders. In other words, we don't represent either the company, nor do we represent the complainant. It's the party's right to have representation. If they want to have representation, that is always welcomed. We work through the representatives from either side. It's important to note that this process is not anonymous, though. Once the investigation starts, we notify the complainant, the respondent, and any appropriate federal partner agencies that we have opened an investigation. And all evidence should be submitted to the investigator for the case. All evidence is shared with all parties during these cases. And I will say that investigations vary in length of time, but it can be a lengthy process. We let everybody know that up front. At any point, the parties may settle the complaint either through our alternative dispute resolution program or with the assistance of the investigator who's working the case. And then you should also know, if you get a hold of us, the claim will be thoroughly investigated. And as the complainant, your cooperation is imperative to the complaint. And we also stress that this is an administrative investigation, meaning that there's no litigation, there's no lawsuits going on. We're just investigating the complaint. And at the end of the investigation, the investigator just makes a recommendation to his or her supervisor. And if the supervisor then concurs, OSHA will issue a findings letter, which will include information about appeal rights to all parties.
I understand that you don't represent either the complainant or the respondent, but the whistleblower program can assist with settlement recommendations. How does that work?
Yes, settlement can occur at any point in an investigation, and it can either be done by our alternative dispute resolution coordinator, which we have a great one on staff, or it can be done by the investigator. The different thing about working with the ADR coordinator is that all the information exchanged during that settlement is confidential. So it kind of goes out of the investigator's purview and over to the ADR coordinator, and they work it. And if it doesn't work, then it comes back to the investigator, but we know nothing about what went on in the ADR process. We just go back to investigating it from where we left off the last time that we were investigating it. As we discussed earlier, there are several types of settlements that can be reached. In one case that I worked, a worker had some sick days and some bonuses that hadn't been paid, And so I negotiated a settlement to cover that. It's not always large sums, but it's always something that's important to the employee.
So what type of career path leads one to work for the Whistleblower Protection Program? What kind of degrees do you recommend people have or experiences?
Well, honestly, we're from all over. There is no standard, this is what you need to do or what you need to be a whistleblower. We have some former and even current military. We have Peace Corps. We have former teachers. We have EEO professionals, railroad inspectors. We have some former compliance officers, some police officers. We have everything. So the best thing is just life experience, I would say.
Terrific. What kind of degrees do people typically have, or do some of you or your coworkers have?
I can speak on experience, for I know that two of us have teaching degrees.
Wonderful. This is Rebecca Markham Parker. We spoke with Sarah Linthicum of OSHA's Whistleblower Protection Program on KKFI's Heartland Labor Forum, 90.1 FM. We're going to dedicate this song to the auto workers. It's War on the Workers by Ann Feeney.
Listen up, we've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us, fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots. Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon's solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots. When they boost your copay,
war on the workers.
Don't you know what to say?
War on the workers.
When they talk privatization,
war on the workers.
And cooperation,
war on the workers.
When they call you a team,
war on the workers.
You better learn how to scream.
War on the workers.
Oh, that's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, flexibility.
War on the workers.
Every work I'm stiff can see.
War on the workers.
Now when they poison your water.
War on the workers.
Don't pull like lambs to the slaughter.
War on the workers.
And when they foul up the air.
War on the workers.
You gotta show that you care.
War on the workers.
When they talk WTO.
War on the workers.
You best be screaming hell no.
War on the workers.
Education. It's a war on child labor protection. It's a war on the 8-hour day. It's a war on occupational health and safety. It's a war on social security. Now thanks to WTO, GATT, NAFTA, MAI, the IMF, and the World Bank, it's a worldwide war. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Yeah, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time, sisters and brothers, you know it's time right now. I said it's time. We started calling the shots.
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Blockman, Journeyman Wireman of IBEW Local 124. Tonight I'm going to share the story of the longest strike against a major manufacturer the UAW had yet seen, the 113-day strike beginning in November of 1945. It is my determined belief that there can be no permanent prosperity so long as the controls of production remain in the hands of a privileged minority. Those are the words of a central character to this drama, Mr. Walter Reuther. As previously covered in this show, the end of World War II brought on the largest strike wave the United States had ever seen. Wages had been suppressed during wartime, and anyone who spoke of doing anything about it was labeled as un-American and not supportive of the war effort. When the war ended, a lot of people in a lot of industries had some words for their bosses. Walter Reuther of the UAW contended that the huge gains in industrial productivity could mean permanent prosperity for the American people, but that instead, a relatively few greedy industrialists, such as those of GM management, controlled and manipulated our economic system to prevent that. Reuther pointed to examples within the microcosm of GM by pointing out a tactic being employed by management that boosted product prices by engineering an artificial scarcity, all the while endeavoring to cut and suppress the wages and benefits of the workforce that produced these products. Reuther pointed out that if this perspective continued, we may reach a point where we may have a depressed economy simply from workers being unable to produce the goods that they produce or meet social needs, ultimately leading to the degradation of public infrastructure such as roads, schools, and bridges through starvation of taxpayer funding. As a personal aside, Reuther sounds a bit prophetic here from the perspective of 2023. Walter Reuther was not the president of the UAW, but was the UAW's head of the General Motors Department, the part of the union assigned to deal with that employer. His argument and solution was bold. He pointed to incredible company profits and called for a 30% wage hike for workers, as well as the ability of the workers to freeze the price of new products to prevent them from becoming any more unaffordable. GM management called that demand excessive, saying they could never afford it, and scoffed outright at the demand to freeze new car prices. They said the right to determine product pricing was solely the right of management, and that no input was sought from the workers making the products. The UAW and Reuther replied, "Well, we will drop our demands to freeze products prices if you will open the company financial books and show how they were struggling rather than thriving." Management outright refused, saying that such a demand was not only anti-American, but socialist. Reuther replied that as long as the powers and decisions of the economy remained in the hands of a rich, privileged few rather than being decided more democratically, lasting prosperity for the majority of people could never come. The UAW didn't back down. Instead of walking out all at once, a move which could have seen their contemporary strike fund drained in around 11 weeks, following an idea from Reuther, they decided to instead target one plant at a time in a bid to disrupt the chain of production in unpredictable and difficult to compensate for ways. Unfortunately for the UAW workers and their ambitions of 30% raises, the existing strike wave was already being absorbed and redirected by the management in other companies. Earlier to fight and earlier to settle back down were several other unions, including the United Electrical Workers and the United Steel Workers, both of which had accepted 17.5% raises. In the final contract with GM, the UAW workers received a raise of precisely the same amount on the check, but also won paid vacations and overtimes, something they did not win, the right to influence the pricing on the products they produced. In the aftermath of the strike wave following the end of the war, conservatives were seemingly galvanized by their opposition to the strikes and gained a slim majority in Congress. This soon yielded the infamous Taft-Hartley Act, among other things that outlawed the closed shop, mandatory union membership in a union-organized workplace, and opened the door for the so-called right-to-work state. It outlawed certain kinds of strikes altogether, and made union officers swear oaths to the U.S. Department of Labor stating that they were not communists, among other things. The Taft-Hartley Act remains in effect to this day, though several amendments have been made and courts have deemed some parts unconstitutional. Have a great evening, everyone.
Okay, and now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. You can find our calendar on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page, where you can like it and tell your friends about it, too. The Wyandotte County Democratic Breakfast is going to be this Saturday, 8:15 for breakfast in the morning, 9:15 for the speakers. It's at Las Islas VIP Sports Bar and Grill at 4929 State Avenue in KCK. Speakers are candidates for local commission and BPU election, and Jenna Repass, the Kansas Democratic Party chair, will be there too. The UU Forum is back, and they're going to be talking Sunday about nuclear energy, its blessing and a curse, with Ken Schmitz at 9:30 a.m. Sunday, September 17th at All Souls UU Church at 4501 Walnut, Kent City, or on YouTube, on their YouTube channel. Just go to the All Souls UU Church and find it. Where we stand regarding the right to reproductive freedom ballot initiative in Missouri and surrounding area states, Monday, September 18th, 5:30 to 7 p.m. online. There's a Zoom link, and you can find it on our Facebook page. Possible National Day of Action to support the UAW, which is possibly going to be on strike, next Wednesday, September 20th. Time and place will be announced. Labor Notes online workshop, Race and Labor, Wednesday, September 20th and 27th, 7 to 9 p.m. Register at labornotes.org/events. KCK Board of Public Utilities Candidate Forum, Tuesday, September 26th, 6 to 7:30 p.m. Online, register at the article. Oh, this one is the Kansas City Beacon article. I got it in the wrong place. Reverse the Rent Hike Rally at Parvin Estates, Thursday, September 28th, 11:45 a.m. to 12:30 p.m., 4029 Bel Air Avenue, Kansas City. That's in the Northland, sponsored by KC Tenants. And that's it for our calendar. As I said, you can find it on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to be talking about what's the matter with Kansas workers' comp and the new McCarthyism. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's guest engineer, Scott Stanton. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's Shots in the Night Radio Theater.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss. And you can talk back to us, too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM KKFI.
We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be. Said if I were Frank Sinatra, I'd pull strings, and through political pull, you'd be on top of the glorified garbage pile with all of their plastic smiles. You'd be with all the self-appointed kings and queens, with all their power and wealth and the material things that symbolize the greed that's keeping the world. You would be the darling of the Reagans and the Trump's son, never to acknowledge the conditions where you've come from, to struggle and fight for the common man's rights to be.